The Coen brothers' film Blood Simple was a big deal for the actor Frances McDormand. It's where she met her husband, the director Joel Coen. It was her first part in a film, and the critic and writer Isaac Butler says it was a role that gave her a technique for acting that she would call on again and again. McDormand played a woman named Abby in the film. Butler says it's a deceptively difficult character to play. Abby is at the center of it all, but she doesn't really have that many lines. She's mostly just reacting. Still, Butler told us McDormand really struggled with the role, and she realized just how hard this was going to be when they shot the crucial action sequence of the story.
Her lover has been murdered by a man who's kind of stalking them, and she has to enter a room, see his dead body, run through the room in which his body is lying, and into a bathroom and close and lock the door. And she has to run into the bathroom because she is fleeing the man who has killed her lover. And she, by her own testimony, had sort of not really realized in reading the screenplay what it would take to do that. That it was this sort of really emotionally intense moment, reenacting this kind of traumatic event in the character's life. And so she used an exercise that she had done in graduate school. She had one of the people there on set grab her by the arms and refuse to let her go until the director, Joel Coen, called action. And the reason why she did this was to kind of whip herself into a frenzy. She was going to struggle against the person holding her. It gets you really upset when you do that. It's a very upsetting thing to not have control over your own body. And so Joel Coen called action, and the guy let go of her, and she ran across the room seeing the dead body of the lover, and she's at this peak of emotion. She runs into the bathroom, and the director calls cut. And she realized at that point that she had really gotten herself in trouble, because she was going to have to do that again and again and again all day. Because unlike in theater, in film, you have to repeat these things over and over and over again while they shoot them from different angles or get the shot right. Or, you know, someone flubs a line, you got to do it again, adjust things. It's very difficult to do those emotional moments. And so she kind of fled under a table that was on the set to isolate herself and recover emotionally and get to the point where she could get calm enough that she could do that again so that she could protect herself. And Joel Coen came under the table with her. It's actually kind of a very romantic moment. He kind of scurries under the table to her, and he just realized that what she really needed was someone who could kind of calmly tell her what her job was going to be. And so he very calmly said, okay, this is the next shot. We're going to do this thing. And that's how they proceeded throughout the day of shooting. Part of what came out of that was their relationship. But another thing that came out of that was McDormand realizing that she was going to need a system, a series of techniques, a method of working that would allow her to release those things that needed to be released on camera, but then also to control it so that she could take care of herself and still be a healthy person at the end of the day.
What interests you about that?
A lot of different things interest me about that. One of them is just the idea that you could have such control over yourself and over your body and your voice and your psychology and your emotions, that you would be able to do that sort of thing. But another thing that interests me about that is that it's only very recently in the history of acting that we actually thought that was a good thing. For most of the history of acting, it was presentational, it was oratorical, a lot similar to what opera performance is like today. And even for the first few decades of film acting, you know, the idea that you could really lose yourself in the part, or that you were trying to convince the audience that you were really the person, or that you would really be feeling real emotion, was not really the goal of acting. And so I was really fascinated by that transition in our norms and our ideas of what makes for good acting. And the more I looked into that story, the more I realized that it was also the story of the nature of acting and directing and writing and theater and film changing.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Isaac Butler's book, his history of this transformation in acting, is called The Method. You hear about the method all the time in stories about actors like Daniel Day-Lewis or Robert De Niro staying in character off camera, doing exhaustive research for their roles, but that's not necessarily the method. In fact, Butler told us just what this method is hard to describe.
I think that we want to be transported into the world of the character. We want to feel like the actor and the character have to some extent become one, that the actor is to some extent really experiencing what the character is going through. We want to feel like those emotions are real, that we can see what the character is thinking on some level because the actor might be thinking it themselves. We want to collapse that distance between the performer and the role. And that just wasn't always true. That wasn't always what we as a society wanted. But I do feel like that's what we want now.
It's what we want now. But you do spend some time just talking about how for hundreds and hundreds of years, the idea of an actor trying to experience a character that they were playing was just like wrong. It was not desirable. Talk a little bit about the way for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, acting was supposed to be just mostly kind of about technique and symbolism, and it was technical, I guess.
Yeah, it was absolutely a technical job that was about the body and about the voice and about one's oratorical gifts and about, depending on which period you're talking about, often actually about very conventionalized systems of behavior. You know, if you're playing a role on stage in the 19th century, in the early 19th century especially, you could learn how to display the correct series of emotions from a book. You could literally buy a book and it would tell you, like, oh, the pose of grief is you extend your hands in this particular way. And, you know, a lot of acting was that. People were very suspicious of the idea that you should really experience the role. They were suspicious of it for a bunch of different reasons. In some cases, they thought it was actually dangerous. You know, what if you got so lost in the part that you hurt yourself or hurt other people? Sometimes it was because, you know, we were post-enlightenment, and so we were reasonable people now, right? Because the enlightenment had happened and everything is very reasonable. And if you're going to go and experience the part, you're actually disrupting this idea of what a human being is, that a human being proceeds largely from reason. And we wanted acting that reflected that.
What is it that people don't understand about the method? Daniel Day-Lewis is doing the method when he stays in character on a set.
Even though he said, I'm not doing the method.
Right, exactly. Or it just seems like there's a lot of mythology surrounding the idea of what the method is and how it's actually practice. What is it that people aren't getting, do you think?
Well, here's what people think the method is. They think that the method is a process of incredibly intense research where the actor attempts to essentially live as close to the life of the character as possible to try to kind of figure the character out. Daniel Day-Lewis, I think, built his own house for The Crucible or something like that. I mean, that's a perfect example of it. Or, you know, Jeremy Strong on set for Succession, when his character is supposed to be drunk, will often have a drink before going on set. People will gain and lose weight, et cetera, and so forth. The lineage of that process can actually be traced to Robert De Niro and his work in the 1970s that culminates in Raging Bull. Those are all things that Robert De Niro would do, somewhat maybe taken to their furthest possible, and in Jared Leto's case, self-parodic extent, right? But Robert De Niro studied a little bit with Lee Strasberg, but he didn't really like him. He was actually practicing his own take on what he had learned from his teacher, Stella Adler, who was Lee Strasberg's bitter, bitter lifelong rival as an acting teacher. Yeah. So what the method actually is the specific tranche of Stanislavski adaptation in United States acting taught and practiced by Lee Strasberg. It is his specific take on that. It is all about not the external behavioral habits of the character, which is what the post De Niro process is. Mm-hmm. It is about the actor, because the actor is their own material. They are the painter and the paint, right? And what Strasberg wanted to do was for you as the painter to have the most developed, complex, full palette of colors at your disposal. And the way you did that was by unlocking your own idiosyncrasy, your own psychology, your own emotion, your own life experience, and then using that to connect to the character. It is, so it's not this research-driven process. Actually, he would often speak very dismissively of actors doing too much research, right? It's instead about you using yourself in as deep and profound a way as you possibly can. Mm.
So let's back up and talk about Stanislavski. He's wealthy.
Yeah.
He runs his family's factories.
Yep.
Fancies himself a decent actor. I'm not sure how good he was. And you talk about how his ideas, they didn't come out of nowhere, you say.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about, I'm interested in Mikhail Shepkin.
Mikhail Shepkin's such an interesting figure, right?
Yeah, but and he was taught this particular, because I guess there's this impression, and I may have had it as well, that the idea of naturalistic or naturalism as a style started with Stanislavski, but it started before that, and he was influenced to some degree by that.
Yeah, I mean, in a weird way, like, there are no original ideas, right? Everyone's influenced by something. Every idea has a lineage. Stanislavski jokes around a lot about himself as an actor, but his reputation during his own life was that he was a truly brilliant one. But he inherited, I would say, his ideas about naturalism and the value of naturalism and of acting as close to what a real person would act like from this guy, Mikhail Shepkin. He did not study with Shepkin. Shepkin died around the time that Stanislavski was born. But Shepkin is really the father of naturalistic acting in Russia. He was originally a serf. Shepkin eventually earns enough from his acting to buy his and his family's freedom. And then he, at the Mali Theater, he becomes this sort of guru of naturalistic acting. He is this genius. I mean, I have no idea because I didn't get to see him perform, unfortunately, right? But he is the tip of the spear. He creates this new form of naturalistic acting. Now, it should be said that's not an internally naturalistic acting. It's not about psychology. No one had kind of figured that out yet. It was about style. It was about a less presentational, less oratorical, more realistic, more behavioral driven style. And he
crawl into the skin of your character.
Crawl into the skin of your character. Yes, that's exactly right. That's what he told actors to do instead of showing off for the audience, right? And he trained a bunch of people, and Stanislavski worked with the people that he had trained, including this guy Fedotov was his main kind of teacher, who he absolutely adored. And Fedotov really drilled him and kicked his butt and taught him to kind of restrain his more show-offy impulses so that he could really kind of crawl into the skin of the character.
Yeah. I think it's important to say, Isaac, as you do in the book, I mean, you spend a good bit of time writing about this Russian period. Say something about the moment here, because you write about how Russia at the time, at this point, when Stanislavski is emerging, is, and this is how you put it in the book, is hungering for a kind of truth that the state refused to provide. What's the context here for the period that we need to understand, do you think?
Yeah. So Russia goes through a period of relative liberalization in the mid-19th century. Among other things, the serfs are granted their liberation. Censorship is relaxed. There begin to be these systems of local autonomy over various provinces starts to be extended. And there's what appears to be the gradual change towards a real civil service, and maybe eventually a constitutional monarchy is set in motion in the mid-19th century. But the czar who sets all that stuff in motion dies, and he is replaced by another czar whose nickname is the Colossus, who has a kind of Hobbesian Leviathan idea of what the czar's role is. And he begins trying to claw as much of that stuff back as possible. He weakens the professional civil service, and he tries to destroy the local council system. He's really trying to take all that back, and censorship starts tightening again. And so in the 1880s and 1890s, which then moved to Tsar Nicholas, who's of course the last Tsar of Russia, you have a government that's really built on reinforcing autocracy. And the people of Russia exist under multiple overlapping systems of censorship. And so the people just are not getting the truth from the government. Most of the people are illiterate. And so then the government is controlling all verbal means of expression as well, because they don't want this stuff. They don't want these constitutional monarchist ideas to start spreading. They don't want the idea that the people can have a say in their government to start spreading. And so the arts become this place that people go to for the truth. Mm-hmm. That's true in painting. Russian realistic painting emerges in the 19th century. And that's also true in acting, that you wanted actors who could reveal subtext, right? Because subtext is where the truth lies. And it's interesting to me for a number of different reasons. I find Russia totally fascinating. But one of the ways it's interesting is that this is also what the method does in the United States in the 1950s, when we become a culture obsessed with conformity and afraid of communism. When HUAC is at the height of its power, the method arises then as well to be like, look at this subtext. So we're showing you this story about these teenagers, but look at their faces. They're being destroyed. You know, they have all this stuff they don't want to say. They're showing us that the truth of our existence is one of real repression, and that repression was dangerous.
Yeah, there's a through line.
Yeah, exactly. And that was, you know, when I realized that while researching the Russian section, I was sort of like, oh, game on. This is going to be fun.
So Stanislavski, as you write about, he has these two crises of faith, basically.
And that man was like a crisis machine.
He was.
He has a lot of crises, actually. I mean, I feel like, you know, he just keeps, especially if you read My Life in Art, it's like, then I freaked out about this other thing. Then my eggs were overdone at breakfast and I realized I had gotten acting wrong, you know?
Well, let's talk about the time he freaks out in 1905 or 1906.
Yes, what some people call the Stockman crisis. And they call it the Stockman crisis because he was playing Stockman in An Enemy of the People.
Yeah. And Dr. Stockman, yeah.
Yeah, and so the Stockman crisis is simple. He does a thing that happens to actors all the time, which is that he's been performing the role of Stockman for years and he's on tour and he gets up on stage to do it. And he just kind of goes through the motions. The inner fire is gone. The thrill is gone, as B.B. King might say, right? And every artist goes through this. You go through times where it's just not there. You know, that you call the muse and the muse doesn't answer. But he just could not abide that. He just felt that was unacceptable because, you know, art for him was holy. Theater was holy. Yeah. Acting was holy. And you could not to betray the art form, to let down the art form, was a kind of sacrilege. And he was a really demanding perfectionist, especially on himself. And so he set out to find out, how can I be inspired every time I set foot on stage at the exact time that I need to feel this thing and be inspired? Because unlike
he's looking for a system,
and he creates something called the system as a result of that. And so what he starts doing is, at this point, it should be said, because the emphasis on the internality of the actor becomes very controversial after this moment. Stanislavski is focusing on the interior mechanism of the actor because he is a master of the external mechanism of the actor. He is a trained opera baritone. He can dance. He can speak. He can move. He has utter command over his body. And so he's not worried about that part of acting at that moment. He's worried about the interior. And since no one had developed interior-based techniques, that was the thing that actually needed to be dealt with. And he develops a whole series of them. There's a lot of them. I only get into some of them in the book because the book has to be a reasonable length. But he starts with things like concentration and attention. He talks then about how to break a script and a role up into its coherent parts. He starts talking about trying to figure out what the character wants at any given moment and how that motivates them to take action. And he begins thinking about something called affective memory, which is essentially using the sensory details of an emotionally powerful memory in order to trigger the emotion associated with that memory so that you can feel that emotion on demand. That's probably the most controversial of his ideas.
Could I just say, which we'll come back to, but that seems like there were a lot of these concepts that he's working out that he ditched, but it seems like there is a vestigial element of that affective memory that we may still encounter in acting in film.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And effective memory is the core of the method. It is the fundamental technique of the method. And I think even people who don't study the method or study with Lee Strasberg or, well, now study with a teacher of the method since Strasberg's been dead since the early 1980s. Even people who don't do that know about that idea. Right. And I actually think in our contemporary era, when we are very focused on trying to understand trauma, these ideas are at the forefront again, right? We all like now the idea that like actually you could go back and through recalling the sound of the heartbeat monitor in your parents' hospital room the day they died or, you know, whatever, you could then make yourself cry. That doesn't seem so weird to us, you know? Yeah. It might be unhealthy, but it doesn't seem like, what the heck are you talking about? Whereas, you know, in the early 1900s in Russia, you know, you had to really be convinced that that was something that could actually work.
I think it's also important to say, as you mentioned in the book, that Stanislavski saw this system as pretty dynamic, a living thing in some ways. And so it was constantly changing. And it was moving a lot, it seemed, in his life.
Absolutely. So he called it the system, but he styled it in lowercase letters with quotation marks around it. And the reason why he did that is that he thought it should never be finished and codified. He thought it would be dangerous. It would be counterproductive for it ever to become, you know, carved into tablets on Mount Sinai. He really didn't want that. And that poses huge problems when he starts writing a book about it, as you can imagine. If you never want to codify something, don't write a book about it. And so he really wanted it to be a living thing. And he was very interested in experimenting with it constantly. And he would invite people who were very opposed to the system to be parts of those experiments so that he could learn from them. He was a pretty open-minded guy, actually, in a way that I really admire. And as a result, the system is constantly evolving. And so just because Stanislavski said something about the system in 1936, shortly before he died, doesn't mean that he would necessarily have still thought that a decade later. You know, it's really not about, for me anyway, it's not about him as the ultimate authority on the system. And you just sort of go chronologically and whatever is the latest thing is the best idea. You know what I mean? Because who's to say that he wouldn't have thrown that out? There's a story I tell in the book where he's watching, I love this story, which is why it winds up in the book. He's watching some people in a class do an exercise that is his own exercise. He developed this exercise. He thought it up and he taught it to the person who is now doing it with the actors. And he turns to someone next to him and he goes, "What idiot thought that exercise up?" Yeah. And who knows whether he's serious or joking or what, but that gives you a sense of, you know, he was really open. He really wanted to crack this mystery and he didn't care about being right. He cared about solving this problem. And when you care about a solution more than you care about your own correctness, that's going to lead you to change your mind a lot.
Isaac Butler, he's the author of the new book, The Method, How the 20th Century Learned to Act. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER keeps you connected on the air and in your inbox with our weekly newsletters. Hear the latest stories, station projects, and other KUER news with Station Insider. Radio West's newsletter gives fans a behind-the-scenes look and extras from each week's show. And She Votes Utah delivers fresh information for all your political and voting needs. Sign up today at KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the critic and director Isaac Butler is with us talking about the way acting has evolved over time. These days, we take for granted a naturalistic style of acting. The performances we see in movies or TV or even on the stage are not stylized or presentational. They just seem real. But it wasn't always that way. And Butler's new book explores how we got to this point. The book is called The Method, How the 20th Century Learned to Act. You work through what's happening in Moscow, the work going on. And then, of course, there's the Russian Civil War, the Russian Revolution, a lot of uncertainty, including economic uncertainty. And so these actors go on a world tour. I'm sort of synthesizing here, but this gets us to the United States. And this, they arrive, you talk about in the book, right at the time in the United States when people are starting to think more deeply about art and more seriously about the American theater.
Yes, they absolutely could not have arrived at a better time. Yeah. To cause the revolution in American theater that they caused. A bunch of different things are happening at once. First of all, Broadway is getting more serious. Okay, so yeah. Broadway, which is kind of American pop culture at the time, is it's sort of like when prestige drama became a thing on television, right? And suddenly everyone's thinking about how do I take this art form more seriously, tell more complicated, interesting stories, challenge the viewer. You know, it's a pretty similar thing that's going on there. And just to give you an example, you know, Eugene O'Neill wins his first Pulitzer Prize in the early 1920s. It's not his only Pulitzer Prize, but that is a major shift in American taste. Only 2 years before he won it, it went to like a Boulevard sex farce called Why Marry, you know? And after O'Neill wins it, the next winners, if you look over the next decade, it's like Elmer Rice, it's, you know, Miss Lulu Bett, it's serious drama and serious, even when it's a comedy, it's a serious comedy. Like ideas are starting to take over the American stage. And then at the same time, one of the major producing organizations on Broadway is this company called The Guild, which will probably be most famous for producing Oklahoma in a while. But at the time, you know, The Guild is bringing over serious theater from Europe. So there's this real hunger for European things specifically. There's this idea that, you know, we in America are kind of a frivolous people. We're still learning how to write plays and stuff like that. And Europe's where it's at, man. And so let's import as much Europe as possible, you know? At the same time, a homegrown theater system is starting to evolve out of the little theaters, of which, of course, O'Neill was a part. The Washington Square Players, the Neighborhood Playhouse, you know, stuff like that. So everyone's starting to think about how do we make this a more serious art form? And it turns out that you could put on serious things and make money doing it at the same time. Because Broadway, of course, is commercial theater. The nonprofit theater system didn't exist yet. And so all these things kind of swirl together. The hunger to take art more seriously, the hunger for more realistic work, the hunger for European high art. And along comes this Russian company that has for decades been considered the greatest, maybe the greatest theater company in the Western world, but has never been to the United States. And they show up and they just take the country by storm.
Tell the story, Isaac, of the standing ovation. Take us to that moment. It's pretty powerful.
Sure. Yeah. The Moscow Art Theater shows up. It looks like there might be some trouble getting into the country at first because this rumor spreads that they're in the United States to sow pro-communist propaganda and to raise money for the communist cause. Couldn't have been further from the truth. And then they show up and they start performing, and they're performing the hits. I mean, the repertory that they bring to the United States is their most tested and true productions. And one of them is actually the very first play they ever did, which is a play called Tsar Fyodor Ivanovich, which is a kind of like a Shakespearean history play, but a Russian one. And they're performing for an audience that does not speak Russian for the most part. There's sort of this urban legend that, you know, all the Russian and Jewish immigrants went and they filled the houses and that's why the audience was so into it. But that, I don't think that there's like a ton of evidence that that's true, although all those people did come see it. So they're performing in Russian for an English speaking audience. You could buy a play script, but if you didn't do that, you didn't know what was going on, right? And No one knows how this is going to go over. And what actually happens after the January 8th premiere at Al Jolson's Theater is they get a 30-minute standing ovation at the end of the show. The audience stands and applauds for 30 minutes of curtain calls. The New York Times says that with this single play, they put in evidence a technical mastery which is without parallel and modern memory and which has no historic parallel. John Barrymore goes to, they put on a special matinee at a time, you know, for the theater professionals. And John Barrymore goes to see it and he writes the producers a letter saying, "This is the greatest acting company in the world." You know, it's really mind-boggling the impact they had. Everyone became hungry for Stanislavski and the ideas of Stanislavski and the Moscow Art Theater after that, because they just were just so bowled away by what they had seen.
So Richard Bolesławski is stranded in New York for all kinds of complicated reasons. It's a great story, but suffice it to say, he starts giving these lectures with Stanislavski's permission, starts talking about the system, eventually starts a school, which, and forgive me for jumping ahead, but gets us to Lee Strasberg eventually here.
Yes.
Because he's an important figure, of course, obviously. Let's talk about Strasberg. I mean, his ideas. One of the things you say about Strasberg is he had an eye for bullshit.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about what he takes from this system and what he creates and the influence that he has on American acting.
Well, the influence that he has on American acting is extreme. I mean, it's difficult to quantify, you know, but just to give you an example, you know, in the early 1950s, Lee Strasberg takes over the Actors Studio and becomes its artistic director, right? By 1979, 9 of the 10 acting nominees at the Oscars are Actors Studio members. That's just one measure of the extreme impact he had on American acting through the method, which really the method became synonymous with American acting. To be an American actor was to be a method actor, or to dissent from the method. Those were the two things. It was a monolith. It started as an insurgent movement, but it became the monolith. But before that, to rewind to the American Laboratory Theater, Lee Strasberg goes to see the Moscow Art Theater. He's so bowled over by them that he goes to every single performance to study the acting. And then he eventually enrolls at the American Laboratory Theater. And I've actually read his notes from the American Laboratory Theater. His handwritten notes are in his papers in the Library of Congress. And I quote from them in the book. And so you can see the light bulb turn on in those notebooks. You can see the moment where he's like, holy moly, I have found it. And one of the big ones is when Maria Ospenskaya, who's teaching at the American Laboratory Theater, teaches him the effective memory exercise. Yeah. And effective memory will become the core of his acting technique from then on out. It is not the only thing he taught. That's really important. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, he was really entranced by a lot of the other exercises they would do. Ospenskaya would do this thing called 1-minute plays, which were these kinds of etudes where she would kind of give you a situation and you had to act that situation with absolute truth. I think another thing that he takes from Ospenskaya, it has to do with how brutal she was as a teacher, because Strasberg had a real reputation for just tearing people apart. And I think to some extent he got that because he was kind of an unpleasant person. Even people who loved him and were devotees of his would tell you he was kind of an unpleasant person who had a lot of social difficulties and just did not have or believe in the validity of social graces at all. Some of it was that, but some of it was also that the model of acting instruction that he was given was one in which you really tore people apart. And so anyway, he goes to the American Lab Theater, and a few months later, he actually leaves. He was an autodidact. I don't think he really loved being taught acting very much. And he would read book after book after book. He was probably a speed reader, you know? And so he would read everything about acting that he could get his hands on. And he would occasionally audit stuff at the American Lab Theater, we think, probably. And so between all of these things, he starts to develop his own version of Stanislavski's ideas. He's not only drawing on Stanislavski, he's drawing on other people, often proteges of Stanislavski's, like Evgeny Vakhtangov, Richard Boleslavsky, Michael Chekhov. You know, he's drawing on all these other sources and sort of making his own hybrid idea of that technique. And then he really begins to develop and teach it with the theater company he co-founded, the Group Theater.
Yeah. Now, De Niro, as you said earlier, he's not drawing on Strasberg. He's drawing on Stella Adler. Stella Adler, the bitter rival of Strasberg, you write about. She hated his guts. But part of it, Isaac, wasn't just that they didn't get along, but she thought that the way his approach to acting was dangerous, was like psychologically damaging. I mean, she felt really strongly about
it. She called it sick. She said he's a sick man who inflicts his sickness on people, I think is a very close paraphrase to something she once said. And she was very open about this. It's not like she wrote that in her diary. She like told that to the New York Times. I mean, you know,
I mean, even when the poor guy died, she didn't have anything good to say.
The first thing she said after I interviewed someone who was in the room with her when she got the phone call that Lee Strasberg had died. And the first thing out of her mouth was, good riddance. Now he will stop ruining actors. So Stella was an actor in the group. She was actually one of the leading actors in the group theater. But she had already been a professional actor since the age of five. She was the daughter of one of the greatest actors of all time, an idol of Lee Strasberg, Jacob Adler, who was a Yiddish theater actor. And so she felt like she knew how to act, and she had studied at the American Laboratory Theater for many years. You know, she knew what she felt like she knew what she was doing, and she did not feel like she needed to go into the absolute depths of herself in order to do this stuff. She was not alone in the group theater. The group theater was very excited by Strasberg's ideas and then got kind of disillusioned by them over the course of the decade of its existence. But she was the one who was really complaining the most. And they just fought all the time because Strasberg was directing her and she was resisting him, and they did not get along. And this eventually, I think, helped fuel a real schism between them. So in the mid 1930s, Stella Adler goes to Europe. She goes to Moscow. She goes to see a bunch of theater. And then she and Harold Clurman, who's one of the co-founders of the group, and her on again, off again lover, and eventually her husband, they wind up in Paris. And she finds out that Stanislavski is in Paris, and Stanislavski is Harold's hero. And so he takes her to go meet Stanislavski. And, she tells Stanislavski to his face, I used to like acting until I studied your system, and now I hate it, and it's ruined me. And he says to her, this is, you know, a great meeting you know, she met exactly the right person to say that to their face. Because Stanislavski says, well, you know, maybe you don't understand it, or maybe you haven't been taught it correctly. I don't know, but why don't you come to me tomorrow and let me see if I can help you. And so she has a scene that was giving her trouble translated into French. And then she and Stanislavski worked together in French because he didn't speak English for the next few weeks. And no notes of those sessions survive. But when she comes back to the United States, she says, Stanislavski told me Lee got it all wrong. The key to the system is not emotion. The key to the system is imagination. It is script analysis. It is problems and actions. It is thinking through character behavior and what the character is doing and what they want at any given moment. That is the key to the system.
So Strasberg thinks it's inward out. Adler says, no, start out, go in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. But not starting out in the sort of British technical sense of, you know, that. It is about being in the world and what is the character's world like? What are their, the term is the given circumstances, which is everything the text tells you about the character's life and world, and really understanding those and imaginatively entering those. That is where the great performance comes from. And so, To me personally, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. I think Stanislavski valued both of those things, you know? Right. Partially as a result of this schism, Lee and Stella start taking ever more extreme positions on this stuff. So in her early classes, Stella is saying effective memory is a thing, but let's not do that right now. Let's do this other stuff, right? By the time we get to the 1970s, she's telling actors not to use their experiences at all. And she's getting very mad at them if they are. And so Robert De Niro studied with Stella Adler. He did not like her very much as a person. She was a very affected person. She had a very grand style, and he was not into that. Marlon Brando, who also studied with Stella Adler, was bewitched by that, but De Niro was not. He did not want a queen lording it over him. And but he really took a lot from what she taught him, and he pushed those ideas about as far as they could possibly go, probably further than Stella would have even approved of. In terms of the amount of research and transformation and stuff that he did to play his parts.
It's Isaac Butler. His new book is called The Method. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
We understand. You don't really want to turn off NPR Utah, but you're busy. You've got no choice but to leave your radio behind. Well, why not turn to KUBR's podcasts? You can take a deep dive into politics, the Utah way, with State Street. Or maybe you're feeling wildly curious, in which case, check out the latest episode of Radio West. And don't miss Sent Away, our investigative podcast about Utah's troubled teen industry. Learn more at KUBR.org/podcast.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The critic and director Isaac Butler is with us today talking about this revolution that transformed the way actors explore and take on their roles. It's come to be known as the method, though Butler told us there's not really one method actors follow. But you can trace this transformation, as he does in his book, back to Russia and the actor and director Konstantin Stanislavski. Butler's book is called The Method. You know, there's another story that has sort of come to us as a myth that you debunk a bit. And it's the story that I'm sure people have heard in the filming of Marathon Man.
Yes.
Where Laurence Olivier is playing alongside, of course, Dustin Hoffman. And Hoffman is, you know, quote unquote, a method actor. Tell the story and sort of break it down a little bit.
Sure.
Because it's a good sort of punchline, but it's not exactly accurate.
Right. So let me tell you the story the way you've probably heard it, right?
Okay.
Dustin Hoffman has to play a character who's exhausted and paranoid and has been out for 2 days. He hasn't slept. He's being chased by Nazis. He's terrified, all this stuff. And so he spends 2 days living like the character lives. He doesn't sleep. He parties. He's really like he's running everywhere to be extra sweaty and bedraggled. And he shows up on set and Laurence Olivier takes one look at him and says, "Have you tried acting, my dear boy?" Right? That's the version that I've always been told. And it's sort of a joke that captures the difference between American and British acting, right?
Right.
When I set out to write this book, I was like, I bet this never happened. I'm going to debunk it, you know, blah, 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 blah. And actually, I discovered something more interesting, which is that it did happen. It just had a different meaning than people think, which is the following. According to Dustin Hoffman, who idolized Olivier and loved him, he was going through a pretty difficult divorce. And so, you know, he knew the character had to stay up for 2 nights. And so he just kind of had this, you know, maybe perhaps mischievous and self-destructive idea of, hey, you know what? I'm going to stay up for 2 nights. I'm going to go to Studio 54. I'm going to party with people. I'm going to use this as kind of an excuse to act out because it'll then help my performance. And so he did. And so he shows up on set and he's talking to Olivier and he relates this story to Olivier with a kind of self-deprecating subtext of like, can you look at this crazy thing that I did over these past few days because I'm a mess. I'm a wreck. I'm having this divorce. I'm playing this part and all this stuff. And Olivier does indeed say, "My dear boy, Have you tried acting? But he means it in a sympathetic way. You know, don't do this to yourself, right? In a like it's okay. You're going through a hard time, but you know, like just, you don't have to do this to yourself. Just do the role. Just do your job.
So the method goes into decline. It really, a decline, you say, it really hasn't emerged from necessarily.
Yeah.
Let's talk about where we are today. You talk about Meryl Streep, for example. You write about her toward the end of the book, how she's personified this kind of new anti-dogmatic approach, where she had had a lot of bad experience with teachers who were trying to explain to her, you know, the method or some version of the method. She has her own bad experience with Hoffman,
yeah,
in Kramer versus Kramer. Talk a little bit about where Meryl Streep is right now, because you say her performance, for example, in Kramer shows how an actor who didn't believe in, you know, the quote unquote method could still get some powerful and naturalistic results. Talk about where Streep sort of fits in where we are today in some ways.
Yeah, I think Streep's a really important transitional figure because, as you say, you know, she really shows that you don't have to go deep into your traumatic past or your psychology or whatever to deliver a truthful feeling performance, right? You really don't need to. And in some ways, I think that was very possible for her because of her natural gifts, you know, because she's just so gifted. She didn't need a set technique in that way. It led to clashes with other actors who were steeped in the method, Dustin Hoffman and Kramer versus Kramer. And so he would do stuff like, you know, there was a take where she had to be upset and he smacked her right before the camera started running so that she would look really upset. In the scene where she is testifying in the custody hearing, right before the camera started rolling, he came up to her and started taunting her about the death of her partner, John Cazale. I mean, really terrible stuff. And as we know from Streep's other performances, totally unnecessary. You know, what emerges in the 80s as the great gurus of the method start to die and as a culture we stop being able to agree about anything is actually a really rich diversity of approach to acting. Like, good acting starts to be a lot of different things. It can be Meryl Streep. It can be Nicolas Cage, who isn't naturalistic at all. It can be John Goodman. It could be Jeff Goldblum. You know, if you think about the act, it can be, you know, the other people who really ascend during this period are the Juilliard actors, Kevin Kline, for example, Patti LuPone. You know, there's a lot of people coming out of Juilliard who become really famous. And Juilliard's whole approach is a synthesis of classical European technique and method techniques. They're synthesizing those two things together. So that leads to a bit to where we are today, where we can't really agree on what good acting is, which is, I think, why the Oscar always goes to like someone who's like putting on a bunch of prosthetics to play a real person. But we don't agree on what good acting is. And good acting can take a lot of different forms. And, you know, you have British actors and American actors working together on the same show. And, you know, but I will say that stylistically, regardless of approach, you'll note that a lot of what people are aiming for is still something that resembles those method performances of the mid to late 20th century.
So, Isaac, finally, I wanted to sort of come around to something you mentioned at the end of the book. You write about how audiences today were just different, that as a country we're fractured, so is this idea of a monolithic audience. And you mention in the book that we're in this new reality, which – a new political reality, you mentioned, which can be terrifying, but you also say it's kind of exciting for art that we are, as you put it, sort of left to our own devices. We have to sort of make our own rules, decide what is good and what is true. Say something about that, if you would, finally.
I feel really torn about this moment that we're in, you know, because being able to decide for yourself what you believe is real and true, that fuels the climate denial movement, right? That fuels vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vaccine movement. You know, a lot of stuff that fuels QAnon. You know, that we are, as individuals, the ultimate authorities on what's real and true or not, has caused a lot of problems. I am not trying to be Pollyanna-ish about that or to just dismiss that. That's like one side of the dialectic for me. But the other side of it is, isn't it exciting in art anyway to get to make our own rules and figure out what is most useful and true am powerful for us, and then to try to find the community that connects on a deep level to that because they feel seen by it, not because they've been told they have to like it. That's a really powerful thing. And where I have hope, because it's hard to find hope sometimes these days, but where I have hope is that that can lead to some exciting new ideas about how art is made, what truths it expresses, how it reflects the human condition, and how we can see ourselves and what a human being is and what it means to be alive in a new way. Because clearly, the ways we're looking at what it means to be a human being right now don't seem to be working out that well for us, right? So I hope that it can maybe lead to what Nemirovich Danchenko called new solutions for the problems of living. And that's, I think, what great new art can do. And that I look forward to.
Isaac Butler, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Isaac Butler. His latest book is The Method, How the 20th Century Learned to Act. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.